Happy New Year, Technorian. Hopefully everyone had a wonderful holiday. Well, I was just going to make a comment about holidays. I don't want to get into it. That's a Starbucks problem. What I will say about the holiday season is it's a reminder of how struggling and troublesome big families can be. I don't know. Most of you guys enjoy it. I have conversations with my friends all the time about where they're going for the holidays, and the lucky ones like, oh, we're going to take a family trip, but we're going like overseas or to somewhere tropical and it's cool. And then there's the ones who I talk to who are like, oh, I'm going to sit down on a couch with my family and listen to everybody bitch about their problems and ask me what I do for a living, which in my case is very difficult because obviously I do this show, but most of the people in my family work with their hands and things. So like to explain that I do this show and we invest in startups and we work with them, and like all of it sounds like magical stuff that does nothing. It sounds like I'm unemployed, which one could argue at times feels that way. But the bottom line is like there's like an art form that I've sort of crafted over years and years of avoiding the conversation. And maybe it's this year. This year was a different year for me in a lot of respects. You know, just 18 was a huge year for Technori, but for me personally. And it's just weird to me to sit and think with family how hard I have to like hide everything. I don't know if that's a problem you guys have or not, but I don't know. I feel like people should maybe, you know, relax, be a little bit more warming and welcoming and a little bit less tense. It seems like everyone I talk to during the holiday season is like tense, and I don't feel like that's the meaning of what holidays are about, but that seems to be where it's gone. So maybe it's just the climate of this country right now. Who knows? Regardless, we do have an awesome show for you. Super excited. If you listen to the Saturday show, a couple months ago, we had Nicole Staple, who's the co-founder of Brideside, on the show. We chatted a little bit about my own personal experience with my wife, Jen, going through the marriage experience, if you will, the pre-planning of the wedding and just everything in general. But you know how the live show goes. You get like 10 minutes or 7 minutes or like really 4 minutes. And it's actually like 2 minutes when you put everything in there. You get like nothing is what I'm saying. So the podcast, obviously you listen to this, so you know, you can talk a lot longer and ask some questions. And get to know the business better. I got to know a lot about what the reason was for Brideside, but I didn't get to find out like how they actually run their business. So I'm going to do that today. Nicole's going to be on the show. But first, let's check the inbox. Most of you don't. Well, if you listen to the show, you should know. But we get a lot of pitches. And when I say a lot, I mean a lot, a lot. Like a lot of companies pitching us on different cool ideas. Some great, some not so great. So what we've decided to do is extract their name in the true Trumpian sense. We just take their name and take it right out. And we're going to read you some of these ideas. And bear in mind, some of these are actually really good ideas. But some, as I mentioned, not so good. So I want to check in with Sam, who's the man behind the box. What's going on, Sam?
Hey, Scott. All right. So you know how prison systems aren't exactly known for communication to the outside world? You're sort of boxed in kind of thing?
I think that's part of the intention.
Okay. Well, sometimes it might be nice for, you know, prisoners to be able to reach out to loved ones or vice versa.
Well, they say it's the incarceration, but it's supposed to I'm forgetting the word here, but like where you're trying to actually rebuild the person so they can come back into society. They don't do much of that in our prison system. So,
all right.
Yeah.
So here's a way to address getting that communication though.
Okay.
Create a company that provides prisoners the opportunity to email, audio call, video chat, or send electronic gifts to other people through a subscription service. Typical prisoner hourly wage is somewhere between 8 cents to 95 cents. Let's say they work 10 hours a day every day. That's like $156 per month, right? So do you think like a subscription fee of $10 a month to communicate in any way, shape, or form to their loved ones is reasonable?
Yes, it is. And this company already exists. It's called Pigeonly. They pitched on our stage about a year ago. Frederick Hudson is an amazing founder. He went to Y Combinator, got some money there, got some money from Techstars, got some money from anyone who's got 500 startups. He's gotten money from pretty much anyone who's got money to give. It's a real problem. It's proven. When I last talked to him, he was doing $3 to $5 million in revenue. So that's proven that you can make money on it. This is the part that maybe you don't know and people out there don't know, but normally I talk about startup companies and say like, if you don't come from that background, if you're like logistics, but then you get into restaurants, you actually have an added advantage because you're sort of looking at it with a fresh eye. Retooling the prison system is one where I feel like if you don't have an understanding of the prison system, I don't know how you're going to solve problems for the prison system. It's just a very weird thing. It's by design insulary. Frederick actually is a felon. He actually served hard time. And while he was in prison, realized that there was a problem and that he wanted to change his life and learned how to code and do all this stuff on his own. And so he created this company. So that is a great idea. I think that they should look for Pigeonly. It's pigeon.ly. Email them and ask if they can join the team, because Pigeonly is getting a lot of traction, and they're in, as far as I'm aware, they're in almost every single prison, like main government, not private, government prison system between here and New York. So great idea. Really need help. Most of these people in prison, as you hear in the news right now, are in prison for really dumb stuff. And they don't need to be in prison for 10 years. And so cutting them off from their family for a decade and then expect them to come back in society is, you know, impossible. So great idea. That's one of the, see, this is what I'm talking about. These are the kind of ideas that come to us. It may not be the first time, and I'm not telling this founder to not do this company. They should do it. If they don't think that they can, you know, if they don't want to join Pigeonly, they can do it on their own. Because in the end of the day, it comes down to execution. So great idea, Sam. Thank you for keeping an eye on the startup inbox.
Always happy to.
Of course. Well, we have a great interview, as I mentioned before, Nicole Staple, co-founder of Brideside. So let's welcome Nicole Staple to the show. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Thanks, Scott. Hey, nice to see you.
So we're not in bride season really so much right now, right? I guess it lives in Chicago.
That's true. It's super cold right now.
Although, truth, when I got married in July, and I think we mentioned this when we did our show, when you were on the live show, the second date we had been given that we could do it was like November, whatever it was. Turned out that was the date that snowed, like whatever. So it was like, good call. Good thing. Like that was the only Saturday we could do. So we chose a Friday. Turns out that was probably a good call. I just feel like a wedding in the city doesn't have the pop when in the middle of the winter. Like that just doesn't feel.
Yeah, no, it's hard to walk outside in fancy dresses and, your guests don't have as much fun,
yeah.
I presume.
Which I guess, so like, it's sort of a good segue into the company itself, Brideside, because there's like, in my perspective, I'm looking at it and I'm like, this is all just going to come together magically and there should be no problems. And as I told you before on the show, I was very fortunate. No bridesmaids, no groomsmen, me and Jen, done. And she had like a friend whose mom, or whose aunt, I can't remember, her aunt owns a bridal shop. And so she was doing all this stuff. So we really did, like, the one thing that normally, like, causes a complete ruckus was super easy for us. But apparently that's not the case for, like, the vast majority of people who get married. Tell me a little bit about the inspiration behind Brideside and, like, what, like, why this exists. And then let's dive into, like, how it exists and what it does. And one of the things that you had sent me, actually, that I thought was fascinating was the David's Bridal, which I actually did catch the news that they had filed for bankruptcy. And it's like, we'll get into this, but like there's a lot of fascinating math around David's
absolutely.
Bridal. So let's start with what made you realize that this is a problem that can be solved?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're absolutely right. The sort of clean, easy bridal party process or wedding planning process isn't what most people experience. And the inspiration for us was really my co-founder, Sonali, who couldn't be here today, but she had 14 bridesmaids in her wedding. And I think she claims that she's still friends with 9 of them or something like that.
Yeah.
So you have to imagine it didn't go as smoothly as she had expected. And what she uncovered while she was going through her own process was that the wedding industry was very much stuck in the past. And this is not just even with bridesmaid dresses. Her wedding planner was using Google Docs for the first time when Sonali introduced it to her. And this was a high-end wedding planner.
How long ago was this?
This was in 2009.
Okay, so like a little while ago, but still not like...
Right,
yeah,
right.
It's definitely past Google.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, when we entered business school, so we met at Kellogg in business school.
Okay.
You know, Sonali was coming up with a lot of ideas in the wedding industry, and I don't know. I had been a bridesmaid, but I didn't want to have anything to do with weddings at the time. I wasn't the sort of, you know, little girl that thought about her wedding her whole life. But I thought the business was super interesting just because there was a wide open space for a new, more digital player to come in and really disrupt this sort of like stodgy old school industry. And we got super fascinated by the bridal retail space. This was a space that had only one player, David's Bridal, who had been the dominant player for over 30 years, and the entire rest of the market was completely fragmented in mom and pop boutiques.
And so, you probably noticed this as a Northwestern person. So I also went to Northwestern.
Yes.
And you're driving down Dempster. And when I went to Northwestern, there was 3 or 4 bridal shops. There was like a mink, like super fancy clothes thing. It's like right in the corner by... I'm forgetting that it's like right where you get off the highway. And then there's like a couple other like places that are in the wedding shop. They're all closed.
right?
They're all closed.
Interesting.
All of them. And that was 2013.
So like right after
they were all going. Like they were still going then, because that was me like coming back from Northwestern. Now I go for the games, and one after another, I started seeing like closeout. They're all gone.
It is completely true. And what we are seeing is that these mom and pop shops not only didn't have the capability to like talk to brides who are now like using Pinterest and using Instagram, but they just they were not evolving with the times.
Can you imagine that though? If you're I want to get myself into the psyche of the mom and pop for a second, because I look at that, I'm like, I'm just thinking. One, there's the dynamic of just our generation being different and like the way that we choose to behave within each other. Like, for example, a mother or a mother-in-law in the previous generations would have been like, this is how it's going to go. We're paying for it. Like, this is how we're going to do it. The liaison between the bridal shop and the person is different now.
Yes.
And that person who communicates with the bridal shop is like, hey, check this out. And they're flip their phone open and like, boop, 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 boop. And the person who runs a bridal shop is like still on a flip phone. They're like, what the hell? Like, it's like fantasy land. So it almost seems to me that like without having someone like Brideside come into this market, I don't think that the bridal shops, like a lot of people like to blame the closing of this to like online. I don't think so. I think the bridal shops and stuff were on their, like there's a void that was going to happen regardless. It was just a matter of who wanted to fill it.
I completely agree. And to your point around walking in a store and showing a store clerk your phone, think about that for a minute, right? You are a young person on the bus going to work, and where are you getting your ideas, your inspiration? You're on Instagram looking at influencers. You're, you know, looking for hashtags that are relevant to what you want. Spring wedding, garden wedding. And
I only look at Kardashian stuff. That's all I got.
You know,
it's my
we'll talk about
blood.
That later.
It's my life's blood.
I judged you a little bit.
As should everyone listening. I'm kidding. I swear to God I am.
You're right. I mean, it seems almost like a nuanced point in some ways, but that exact point that you made around where the customer starts building their relationship with you is exactly what happened in this industry. And that's one of the reasons we can get to this later that I think David's Bridal has failed.
Okay. So let's start talking about this a little bit more on the business side of it, because this is what I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, because obviously it's your business, so you would know it better than I do. I just looked at it from like what I know of the business, a little bit of research, what Crunchbase tells me, and just general market knowledge, that unlike a lot of markets, and I'm going to use a toy industry. This is going to sound kind of weird, but it's a toy industry as what we're going to judge against here. Toys R Us being the David's Bridal. In a lot of businesses, disruption has to take place, and there's a changing of behavior for the market. You have to change the market's behavior in order to get to what you want to do, right? We actually met with and he's been on the show many times, Luke Saunders from Farmer's Fridge, just had breakfast with him. And he was talking about one of the big worries when they put their vending machines is we're going to have to change people's perception of vending machines, right? Very difficult, cost to do a lot of marketing. In your case, and in the toys case, we'll use as an example, the market changed itself. All the things, you don't have to change people's behaviors. They were already changing. They were the reason that I could call it retail locations, brick and mortar, why they were going down. And it was not that you had to disrupt them or that like there was a change coming. The customers simply were not finding value in it enough to do it, and were trying to find another way to do it. And you came in and were like, you know, we could do this a lot better. We can take what we do here, what they do here, what you do here, and put it together, do it online, and boom.
This is actually a really brilliant point you bring up. I completely agree. I've often thought of David's Bridal as not the start of something new, but the nail in the coffin, the end of something old. It's truly sort of a statement to the market that the traditional way of doing things has ended.
Yep.
And I think, you know, your point around toys, right? The behavior was changing. I think about traditional market disruption. So you think about a Warby Parker, lower cost product coming in and starting to chip away at the incumbent Luxottica. Yep. Or you think the other way around, Tesla, a premium product coming into the market and then going down market later to disrupt the incumbent. Yep. This was not like that.
No.
This was a disruption of customer experience and an incumbent not being able to innovate quick enough to meet the customer where she was.
Which, I mean, and to your benefit, and I don't mean to say that it's easier to do it this way than it would be for any other business, because it's not. It has its own set of challenges. But in a lot of ways, this is something where, you know, in some cases, I've got to come up with a strategy to change behavior. I've got to test and come to market with a product that is market ready, because if I don't do it right the first time, I lose them. in your case, the problem was there for you to solve. It was just a matter of like, of whoever jumps to this opportunity, who solves the problem best and then executes at scale. And that's sort of where you guys have done well. And you sort of, again, you know, hit it, I think, perfectly with the David's Bridal and the nail in the coffin. Like Toys R Us, the minute that David's Bridal left the big, I'm just guessing here, if I'm wrong, I don't know what's inside of a David's Bridal because I've never been in one, but I'm just going to guess that there's a gigantic white platform like in the movies, and the bride comes out from like a place full of mirrors, and there's like 1,000 dresses that they try on, and none of them are actually the dress that the person wants, and then they step up on the thing, and everyone goes ooh and ah, and then they judge behind their back. And that's sort of like how this whole thing goes. The minute that they left that looking like that, just like Toys R Us, the minute they left it as a shell with a ton of toys and shit just laying around is the minute that they lost every single thing they had going for them, which was you had customers coming to you, which is so rare, coming to your shop. You could have provided them with a million experiences, and all you did was give them a bad one. Toys R Us lost everybody because the parents had to go in there and listen to these kids screaming and kicking, trying to buy stuff that the parents can't afford, right? What is a bridal shop? A bunch of people in there kicking and screaming, trying to buy something they can't afford. It's the same problem. And they lost out on an opportunity to at least make it fun. The American Doll scenario. American Doll did an amazing job of making it at least tolerable for parents, right? They know the kids are going to want to go. They made it tolerable, and then they can sell marketing, and then you get a book in the mail and it never stops coming, even though you have kids. And they try to sell you stuff nonstop online.
Totally.
But it's all like affordable-ish.
Right, right. I mean, this is, so you highlight the point, which is that to be a big brand at scale, there's going to be, you're going to have a core customer base for sure, but you're going to need to understand and cater to lots of different preferences, and people's preferences are becoming more defined as they use more discovery tools online. And so when you think about a David's Bridal, you know, they had brick and mortar boutiques. They were meeting that customer for the first time when she walked in. They have sort of average sales associates that are asking that person for the first time, what do you want? And then they're trying to upsell her every step of the way. Well, think about a scenario where you think about brick and mortar. Yes, someone maybe still walks into the store, but what about knowing her exact budget range online first, knowing her vision for something, having a sense of what geography she comes from, maybe what demographic she fits into, maybe even speaking to her in some sort of way before she ever walks in the store. So when she walks in, she's seen a highly curated experience. It feels very personalized. She feels like she can afford it. Yep. She feels that she's been taken care of. And then all of a sudden, you're essentially converting customers at a much, much higher rate. You know who should walk in the door, who shouldn't walk in the door. And that square footage or that space that you've created for the customer becomes that much more valuable.
So let's use this to sort of turn towards the strategy of what Brideside does. Because what I think is particularly interesting about what you just said is when a customer comes in, it doesn't matter what business you're in, when a customer comes in to buy something, if they have to begrudgingly buy it, or they have to leave no, like regrettably, like I know I have to have a corsage, I know I have to buy these three things, I don't want them, and they're going to go in the garbage can when I'm done with them, I might not even take them home from the wedding, to be quite honest. When you have to buy stuff like that, you're leaving with a bad taste in your mouth. You're leaving unfulfilled, and if anything else, almost pissed that you went through the experience that way. And you may be forced to go back to David's Bridal should the relationship not work out, or your friends will go back to David's Bridal because it's the only thing on the block at the time. But you're definitely not going to like happily endorse like, oh my God, they made it so easy, you should go there. They're just going to be like, well, there's David Bridal.
Right.
And that's a bad endorsement.
I mean, Bridesmaids is a perfect example of that. I mean, everyone's seen the movie.
I actually love the movie.
Me too, actually. It's one of my favorites, not just because I run this company. But, you know, it gets a bad rap. And obviously, people see Bridesmaids as I have to do this experience. But here's my point. I think we're around the same age. Yep. So I'm almost 35. Yep. And I don't get invited to weddings anymore. And I actually
never did. Is that a problem?
Well, yeah. Maybe that's why you had no groomsmen.
That's actually a very valid point. No, I mean, she went there. That's actually true. But most people.
No, I'm just kidding. It was a good choice.
Just to clarify, I got a reputation with all my friends of being like, I complained about it so much that it's like the idea of it that they all took me off the list because like, dude, we'd have you in the wedding, but we know you don't even want to be here. So we're just going to be respectful of it. And so that's how.
But I don't know about you, but I like look back on like 25 to 32 and like I got to see all my friends all the time. We got to get drunk on the dance floor. It's some of my favorite memories. So what we're saying is, well, maybe it was just the old experience that everyone hated.
Yep.
What if you could buy actually a dress that you loved, you looked like nice in, you could have champagne with your friends, you could actually create moments that you remember. Maybe it's not going to be so crappy after all.
Yeah.
And we have like thought about this a lot, and we really screwed up on this, I would say, when we first launched, around trying to tell the customer we're going to be a less, excuse my language, shitty way to buy dresses. We've now evolved that a lot because what we realized is we actually want to create moments that you can celebrate. We want to help you celebrate with your friends, and we'll do all the dirty work on the back end, and we'll give you the experience that you can remember. And I think actually by repositioning our brand that way, it opened things up. It opened up more opportunity, not only for like products, but also as a brand to say we actually stand for something now.
So I agree with you. We talk to companies, I mean, by the hundred now. And so like, let's say, I don't even know how many times this has happened on the show, multiple times, where they'll give me their pitch, like just real quick, 1 minute, like here's the gist. And I'm like, that is the least, I couldn't be less inspired by what you just said. Like right now you just told me, I'm going to give you, we all want a crappy experience, I'm just going to give you like a less shitty way to do it. And I'm like, oh, that's great. But you could flip it, which you did. You flipped it and made it like, no, we're going to make like a really, you're doing this, you're selling the same thing, but you're able to put it in a way where like, no, we're going to focus on making all the things that have not been fun for you much better and more fun. We're also going to give you the opportunity to have excitement and work with your friends and whatever. You pitch it in a way where people really like, they want to buy it, as opposed to I don't want to have to deal with it. It's like the opposite end of the spectrum.
Right. You're selling an experience.
Correct. So how do you deliver this with Brideside? What is the, give me the example of why I'm going to Brideside and I'm having a great time and I went to Toys R Us and I had a horrible time.
Yeah, sure. So what usually happens with Brideside is a bride discovers our website first, and she oftentimes signs up to connect with a stylist.
Yep.
Usually within a few hours, the stylist reaches out to her. Now, our stylist...
How are they finding this? Is it like, so we have like Julie Novak on the show a bunch of times with Party Slate.
Right.
And the idea there is, I know it's different from you, but the idea there is it, you can see something inspirational, click on it, and actually reach out to the person who created what you saw. Is it similar to where you're shopping for brides?
Yeah.
Or is it,
I mean, so now we have like a lot of acquisition channels, but I will say brides are sort of easy to target in some sense because they're searching online for something relevant.
They're scrolling all day long.
Right. So we're, huge Instagram following, focus on advertising on Pinterest and having a visible presence there, but also traditional things like Facebook and AdWords. You know, people are looking for things that we know are within our realm of servicing and they'll find us.
I told Jen that like with people with Brideside, like you probably paid like 8 cents a click to get Jen. That's how like easy she made it for you.
Right, exactly.
You opened up and signed into every single thing possible that would be relative to a bridal services, and then you searched everything under the sun.
Right.
She's the cheapest cat there.
Well, you know, one of our big learnings was actually by getting the bride to sign up, we had a lot more control over the process. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big part of our experience. It's not super cheap to get someone to sign up, but we have really high rates of converting her to a paying customer once we do, because we reach out to her, right? We reach out to her right away. She fills out a style survey. We get 20 data inputs into our system before we even talk to her. So by the time she's engaging with our e-commerce experience, or she's receiving a custom style board, or making an appointment in our showroom, we have pretty deep knowledge of her. So to your question around like why, like what happens next, if she's near a showroom, she may come into that showroom with her friends. It's usually an hour appointment, and walks out with a good idea of what they want to buy, and they buy online later. If she doesn't live near a showroom, a stylist can curate a try at home box for her. Like I said, send her free swatches. These things just provide that little touch that makes her feel like she's being heard, and she can go from 600 potential products to the 3 that work best for her.
Yep.
And that solving that paradox of choice and like getting her to the right answer quickly has been a big part of like succeeding in this category.
So I want to ask you a question. This is my intuition in this. And I feel like, again, this is a generational thing. I don't mean to make this podcast always generational, but I just feel like unlike every other generation, there is just a distinctness to what we are. Maybe it's social media, but like there's something that makes us very different from the average. Like you look at almost every expensive brand, doesn't matter what line of industry, cars, it is always very high touch. And it's always like, come in and we're going to surround you with stuff and you do all this stuff. And I think you hit it on the head by offering limiting the choices and making it easier for decision making, less things to think about makes it easier. But, and it's high touch in that, like, I got to know you, so I curated an experience for you. Doesn't mean you're getting a ton of stuff. I just know enough about you to give you only what I think you're going to want. we've gotten to a point where luxury brands that are continually still working, not exclusively, but a lot, luxury brands that are working in a way where you have to come in and you have to spend a day there and you've got to do all this stuff. It's like, ugh, I don't even want to go. And so I think one of the things that you've really, I don't know if it was intentional or unintentional, it's probably very intentional now, but however you stumbled upon it, the demographic of people you're shopping to that are using Brideside, I've got to imagine that one of the biggest selling points to them is that they get all the things they wanted out of the luxury experience without any of the bullshit that goes with the luxury experience.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. I mean, and even if they're not buying a super expensive product, they still feel like they got a luxury experience.
Because they don't look at it like that. They're not, like, they're only a few people. I mean, that's not a lie. There's a ton of people like this, but there's like, there are a good amount of people who look at what they spend on something and they qualify like, oh, well, I spent $500, so therefore it's the best, right, even though $50 was sufficient. Bridal dresses is one of those things where, again, because of who is paying for it and how it goes, usually it's, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but usually it's not the bride who just like pays for that and certainly doesn't pay for the bridesmaid. They're not looking at it like that. They're like, what is the most beautiful? What is the thing I like?
Right.
And the price comes later. And so it's
That's been like a very interesting dynamic of this is very specific to our company, right?
Yep.
We're like targeting the bride, but at the end of the day, the bridesmaids are buying from us and she's going to be less excited about our brand probably than the bride. Yep. And that's something actually that's really hard and that we thought a lot about. And we really try to solve for that. However, we're about to launch the bridal gown and that's going to be very interesting for us because now we have built this reputation for being the gold standard in service and the experience and providing fairly affordable product and really high quality product at a good price. And so when we enter the bridal gown, we have so many questions around this. We're very intrigued around what that will do for that sort of like high touch experience. How demanding will that new customer be? Will this lead to a growth rate in our bridesmaid dress sales because now we're getting more brides in the door earlier? There's a lot of interesting, I think.
So I was going to ask you about the scale. We can still do that, but I want to dig in more on this topic because if you're okay talking more about the bridal part of this, because I think it's a smart business. Obviously, you guys do very solid revenue from what it sounds like. So it's a good business. I think that the move into having the bride herself is genius because, and I think there's a whole bunch of people who maybe would be listening to this right now who are what you would call early adopters. And I, of course, you and I both are very in this bubble of tech. So like to us, it's like, well, what a no-brainer. But I perpetually live 4 years ahead of this. It's like right now I'm talking to you, it's almost 2019. It's like 2023 in my head. So I'm looking at this and I'm going, there are people who might be resistant to this right now. They might be like, well, that's not how we do it. We don't, you know, the bride wants to have this thing. They want to have the party there and the mom and everybody's there. My gut instinct is that just like everything you've seen with the bridal party, the bride herself is jealous that all of these people don't have to go and spend all day long in David's bridal.
Like I
think of all of the people, everyone who works for me, when I tell them to go places, if it's like a quick stop and I can just pick it up and no one's there, they're like, all right, fine. If there's a bunch of people there and they're gonna have to stop and go through a process, they don't do it.
Well, here's what I think is interesting, and you know, TBD whether this succeeds or not, but I hope that it does. I'll tell you why we started with the bridesmaid dress. We started because we'd be working with big groups of women.
Sure.
So we were like, okay, we're trying to launch a digital company in a industry that is literally refusing to go digital.
Yep.
So if we were to launch the bridal gown, we're going to spend all this money on technology and product research and product development and whatever, and it's going to be one and done. But what if we work with our friends? We'll work with our six friends.
Repeat
we'll bring
customers.
Them in, right? We create this repeat viral loop. We'll create all this brand loyalty,
super
become
smart.
A cool brand, and then almost like, I mean, sort of, then we'll go, then we'll tap into the bride,
right? How many bridesmaids are typically in a wedding party?
Around five.
So I look at that as like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm looking at the math and I'm thinking, at minimum, there's two referrals and potentially one actual client as a bride.
That's exactly right. We see like, at least one to two bridesmaids or brides come back and use us with another bridal party. So that was the reason why. And we tried to be thoughtful of that as we built the experience and technology. So we flipped sort of the David's bridal approach, which was gown first on its head.
Yep.
And I'll let you know in 18 months if it worked.
I mean, you can come back and talk about it. I don't think you're going to have to worry about it. I think I can see it being, you know, your marketing costs are going to go up. Your cost of acquisition is probably going to go up. I don't know that it'll be as hard as you think it'll be because you'll have brides who have been involved as a right. previously as a bridesmaid, or brides themselves who have been involved in this some way or another, who are like telling their friend like, oh my God, it was awful.
Right.
So you should definitely try anything other than this one. And like, so you have, unlike the original conversation we had where we're talking about you have to drag them and change, this is actually them as an advocate. Mm-hmm. They're going to advocate for you because the experience that David's bridal gave them was such a shit job that they were like, oh my God, like do anything except for what I did. and so I think it's smart. And like I said, the only thing I have is I think that there's a stigma around the bride and like all the things. But I think that when you really drill down into like human being behavior, I think that our generation and younger, I'm 34, going to be 35 in May. Our demographic is on the like right on the tip where we still want to be traditional because our parents care. Everybody else is already pissed off their parents. They're living in their basement. They're covering all their debt. So they don't care. They literally just want to get married and like do their thing. And if you can offer, like maybe it's not this year and the next year, but I guarantee you by year three of doing that, you will have tapped into the 25 to 27 year old brides to be who are just like, yes, from Instagram and Pinterest straight to your website. Mm-hmm. No, nobody in the middle.
Right.
Totally.
Yeah,
totally. So let's talk a little bit before we wrap up here on the scaling part, because we want to make sure that Brideside doesn't become David's bridal of the internet. So like how do you build this team out? What was the experience? Did you both start this right out of Kellogg?
We started it right out of Kellogg, yes. And we went through a technology incubator and launched it shortly after that.
Did you use Kellogg as your like business plan checks and balances?
Absolutely.
That's what I did too. My first company I was there, I was yep. like, it's like, I got all these professors who want to take a percentage of my company to become an advisor, but if I just wait, or rather, they want that if I wait, but if I just do this right now and run it through, the worst they could do is give me a bad grade.
You're surrounded by hundreds of really smart classmates
who
will give you like focus groups. Yeah, so we definitely took a lot of the concept through there. Yeah, so initially we were all online, and now as you sort of pointed out, we have expanded quite a bit to also tap into the relationship between brick and mortar and online.
Great,
so we have several
experiences.
Right, so several showrooms now. And so, you know, an interesting question then, where do we scale from here? So David's Bridal, just as a benchmark, has 330 stores, around a $700 million business. Yep. So we think that given what we see in our showrooms, we could have like a third of those stores at the same revenue levels because of the power of the e-commerce channel.
Should sublease it from them, as a joke. Like, you know, they're trying to get out of the lease. It's like Mattress Giant. Like, we'll take it from you.
Right. So that's something we're thinking a lot about. Also, scaling brick and mortar showrooms has been a big learning over the last 18 months. So a lot of my job has really changed. It used to be managing smaller teams of people all here in Chicago. And now it's actually managing three different channels of acquisition through online, you know, offline, and our try at home program, and also groups, you know, large groups in our company that live in different places that are building out our brand in new markets. So it's become a lot more around how do we keep brand consistency across all of those geographies? What organizational design do we need to actually, and what systems do we need to create this true multi-channel experience, which is so much more complex than you could have ever imagined. But I think, again, because we started digital first and went, you know, brick and mortar out from there, it's so much easier than if you started with brick and mortar and tried to back into it.
So I've got two questions for you. One is sort of an innovation question, and the other one is a little more selfish and like a technology play.
Sure.
So I mentioned that we had this conversation with Farmer's Fridge, and we've talked to a bunch of other companies that have been on the show, Red Shelf and others, that are in a space where like totally different business, but in my mind, they're the same business. And that is sort of logistics is the business. And so when I look at it, I'm thinking, technology-wise, as you mentioned, you're now in charge of three lines of business, essentially, and you've got to keep your eye on the ball. When you're only growing 10, 15, 25% year over year in growth, it's pretty easy, not easy, but like it's if you're a skilled operator, it's fairly easy for you to be able to just look at it and just like keep an eye on the ball and keep moving. For companies like yours and others that are growing exponentially and you start to get to like 100% growth year over year, it becomes very difficult to manage lines and you start to need like a dashboard to look at everything. Technology-wise, what are you guys doing to be able to stay on top of it at all times? And as an operator leader, how are you able to keep your eye on the wave as it's going and not lose track?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important point. And I think it's so interesting, the decisions you make on day one, how they end up staying with you 4 years down the road. So the thing we did right is we built on really scalable platforms initially. So we're actually, our whole backend is built on Salesforce.
Yep.
Thankfully, Salesforce has evolved so exponentially with us.
Good call.
has opened up so many avenues for consumer businesses now. So our big challenge now is we're actually actually built on, you know, on many systems. In some ways, we have different processes that are managed in different systems, and we're trying to get everything in one place and start to build like the actual architecture for our the business of the future now, before, you know, we hit the point where it becomes complete and utter chaos. So that's something we're super focused on. But again, if you're built on something that can scale with you, it becomes a lot easier.
Well, you made a good choice. Salesforce is up $140 right. a share right now. So they had their quarterly came out like a week and a half ago, and their stock shot up. They're doing well. Good call. My second thing is more on the innovation side. So this is just my brain thinking after I hear you tell me like what you're doing. Is there a play where some of these mom and pop shops that right now, and this is more specifically for the bride, as you try to scale that concept up, can you sort of recreate the wheel of what you did the first time around for the bridal, like for the suite of brides, where you're essentially using the existing brick and mortar mom and pop shops, and they're getting a percentage or a cut or a fee instead of you taking on the lease responsibility and saying, listen, we're going to use your shop like Kohl's does for Amazon for returns. We're going to leverage the fact that you already have a shop. We're going to let you, you know, we're going to send you the dresses, you do the fittings, you do the whatever. Is there a play for you to take advantage of infrastructure that exists that quite honestly are desperate for any sort of revenue stream possible? Or is that not even...
We've definitely thought about it, and we've gotten asked before about it. We've gotten some inbound about it. And also the question of franchise comes up all the time. You know, we see...
I don't know that franchise to me would be that attractive. That comes with people who I don't really care to have in my business right now. Right. I don't mean that in a mean way. I just mean like they that's old and new and usually doesn't go well. Look at what, I mean, McDonald's is amazing, but look at what's going on now. You're starting to get a kind of a shift of gears.
And for retail, if you truly want to be all channel, meaning you create a completely fluid experience between what the customer sees online and what she gets in store, it's very hard to execute on franchise in our business. So yes, we've thought about it, but at the end of the day, like, we fundamentally believe that by like controlling every part of the sales process and the supply chain, we actually can build a probably more lucrative model. So for now,
so like what I'm
sticking
what
to
was,
our guns.
What I was thinking with that one is, honestly, it's not the franchise. What I was thinking of, if you look at like local schools, they rent out the gymnasiums all the time. They rent out all kinds of infrastructure that they have that they can't use. And I'm looking at it like, rather than take out a lease, I would love to tell people like, you can schedule fittings and we're going to rent this local shop and create our own experience in the shop, because they're not going to. And maybe you have them work it. But like, you're essentially just paying for them to do what you tell them to do. They're employed by
well,
you.
Well, one idea we have that, you know, so our showrooms are sort of co-working spaces when we're not taking appointments.
That's exactly.
So our stylists, but for our own teammates now, so our stylists are selling online to customers when they're not taking appointments. Yep. So that space becomes very efficient. But what if our space could also double as industry co-working, right? Weddings is an industry where you have like thousands and thousands of all these individual vendors, planners, photographers, whatever, that are meeting with brides. What if we could sit at the center of all of that? That's something we think about a lot.
That actually blows my mind to think about for a second, because you could absolutely, you don't want to get lost in the real estate play, like, but right. In my mind, I could see the number of people who freelance and how regional it is.
Right.
I mean,
so really at the end of the day, it comes down to, we have a very captive audience. We have a bride and all of her friends, and they're working with us for 9 months, and we have all their data. We're good friends with them in some sense, right? Yep. So what else do you do with that? How else can you service them?
That's interesting. A lot of revenue streams. Ultimately, what is the big goal? I mean, is it the introducing the new sort of bride revenue stream? Is that the big thing going forward? Or do you have anything else? What's the next thing that people are going to see from Brideside?
Yeah, I mean, for now, it's definitely a market grab moment for us. Like, I think David's Bridal was crappy, and I want to create the next generation sort of billion-dollar brand in that world. So for me, that's what I'm focused on. But everything we just talked about around where can it go from there, what are the other revenue streams we open up, is something that we're designing for internally for the long term, while still trying to just, you know, grow revenue on the retail side of the business.
Very cool. Where do people go?
Brideside.com.
Do they follow? Is there a blog? You guys have to have a blog, right? There's got to be something.
You can find the blog on Brideside, but also Instagram at Brideside.
I was going to say, Instagram to me would have been like, that's where I'm playing it. Very cool. Nicole, thank you so much.
Thanks
for coming.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
Of course. You can learn more about upcoming Technori events, investment opportunities, or check out the blog at Technori.com. Download the podcast on Spotify or wherever it is you get your podcast. Follow us on social at Technori, or you can follow me at Katoon. Boom. That's a wrap.